are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, May 22nd, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, House Intelligence Committee makes a deal. Bill Barr does not have to be arrested and held in the congressional dungeon for now, anyways. Newly revealed IRS memo shows that Steve Mnuchin lied about Trump's taxes. And the all-out assault on immigrants spans multiple departments of our government and uses children as a club. Meanwhile, the EPA's incredible assault on our health continues unabated. Nevada ditches the Electoral College, getting somewhat closer to the National Popular Vote Initiative. Mitch McConnell attacks blue slips once more as the Trumpization of our federal judiciary marches on. And speaking of marching, Austria's far right has an oopsie. That's always good for the world. And abortion rights protests held across the country as states begin to shore up their protections for women's sovereignty over their own body. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. Oh, this is... This is sort of cute. Matt, can you put this up on the board here? This just came across my transom, as it were. I just IM'd you. This is really fun. Y'all recall that Harriet Tubman was going to be placed on a $20 bill. It was supposed to coincide with the 100th year anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote. And looks like that's been punted to 2028. Just because, according to Steve Mnuchin, we couldn't get the drawings done. Pretty stunning that, I mean... Supposedly, it is a function of some, I don't know, trouble.
110th anniversary is fun, too.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll have Trump on the other side when it comes out.
This was, the Tubman design was announced in 2016, which I followed like a year-long process. Maybe it was about a year of people pushing this. Now, I don't think it was going to completely. It's Jackson, right? On the 20 now. I don't think it's completely going to get rid of Jackson. I think it was going to be along with Jackson. Although, why not? Why not have a?
Did they take any pictures together? Maybe we could just put a picture of both of them.
Oh, that would have been very sweet. But it's nice you have somebody who was sort of known for. Really, I mean, known for a lot of things, but really his genocide skills, right? And then someone who was working for the rights of people who were denied rights in this country. So it's a nice, supposed to like balance out. And I guess we're just going to have to wait another 8 years because it's so hard to find a good graphic design person, yeah. Apparently.
So a lot of reason why a lot of people that work for me didn't get paid. Got to wait for the right
is job. Is there any doubt that if it was the opposite. If Tubman somehow was already on our $20 bills, and they were like, you know, we really, we really need to put Jackson on our bills, that they wouldn't have gotten this done under the Trump administration.
What are you implying?
You know what I'm implying. Mnuchin says he's focused on security features, not on imagery. Here is Representative Ayanna Pressley from Massachusetts, from my old hometown of Somerville. And she is questioning Steve Mnuchin on this decision. You understand, like, you know, it's U.S. government, they had no idea this was coming down the pike. So, as it were. Here, let's play this, see this exchange. Gonna play this exchange, and here we go.
Currently, our currency does not reflect the diversity of individuals that have contributed to our great American history. He followed the announcement by directing the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to accelerate plans for the redesign, so the final design concepts would be unveiled in 2020, the 100-year anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote, which we celebrated yesterday. As you know, 2020 is only 1 year away, and since Secretary Liu's departure, we have not heard anything regarding the status of the currency redesign. Will the redesign meet the 2020 deadline, yes or no?
So let me comment that the primary reason we've looked at redesigning the currency is for counterfeiting issues. Based upon this, the $20 bill will now not come out till 2028. The $10 bill and the $50 bill will come out with new features beforehand. So the answer is, it is my responsibility now to focus on what is the issue of counterfeiting and the security features. The ultimate decision on the redesign will most likely be another secretary's down the road.
I'm sorry, I just want to be clear for the record. So yes or no, will you meet what was originally the 2020 redesign deadline? Yes or no?
Again, to be clear, the redesign that we are focused on at 20... No, we will meet the security feature redesign in 2020. The imagery feature will not be an issue that comes up until most likely 2026.
And I'm just wondering if you could explain that to me, because after an exhaustive community process where people who organized for quite some time, and you said you do share my sentiments and opinion that our currency should be more reflective of the contributions and the diversity of those contributions. So why the delay?
No, I didn't say that the currency should be reflective.
Well, you said imagery.
I said imagery, not referring to currency.
Okay, so do you believe that?
Things.
Do you support Harriet Tubman being on the $20 bill?
I've made no decision as it relates to that, and that decision won't be made. And as I said,
but there was a community process. There was a national. There was a community process.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about Harriet Tubman that makes those $20 bills so insecure. So insecure. I just cropped
the
up
facial
on the
features easier to counterfeit.
Yeah, it's so it's science. It's science, ladies and gentlemen. All right, let's go to this clip. I'm going to get to some of these stories about what's going on with HUD and also with immigrants in this country, and particularly children are being leveraged by the administration in a despicable but maybe not terribly surprising way. But before we do, we haven't spent too much time on the 2020 primaries. I mean, it's still heating up. Obviously, we're paying some attention to it. We have not said the words Beto O'Rourke in any meaningful way for weeks, and it has been strange.
I've never said that word in a meaningful way, though. I just want to be clear.
Fair enough. But Beto O'Rourke... came out with a huge splash. He since lost some of his key organizers, Becky Bond, who a lot of people, Becky Bond has been on this program both in regards to her organizing during the Bernie campaign and the book that she wrote with her co-author, as well as she was on this program many times when she was working at Credo. Both when they were sponsoring us, but just in terms of their actions, she's a big activist. She left the campaign, not clear why, really. But, you know, it's not hard to figure these things out in some respects as to they moving in different directions. And apparently the direction they were moving in was down. Beto O'Rourke is dropping like a lead balloon, which is impressive to the extent that he wasn't that high up anyways. So there was no ability for the lead to gain velocity as it dropped, right?
That's the way it was, like standing high up on a table, but, you know, in a metaphorical sense, no.
I was born to pull at 7% and do a lot of ridiculous
videos.
Well,
that's the point. He was at 7%, and now he's closer to like 3 or 2%.
It's Becky Bond's fault.
You know, part of it is, and this, again, like, this is why I will reiterate my prediction, and it's just, part of it may be aspirational, that I think Joe Biden in particular is not long for his high poll numbers, or at least this high, because Joe Biden has the advantage that Beto O'Rourke does not have, in that he is that people think they know him, or at the very least they know his name. And they know him as the vice president. And just like with Beto O'Rourke, as it became clear that there was a certain lack of, that his rhetoric did not match up when it started to talk about actual policies. And it's much more difficult this round, it seems to me, in this primary, than in past primaries, to get by without having fully developed and concrete and frankly, appealing policies than it has been in the past, largely because Elizabeth Warren has been coming out with so many proposals, largely because Bernie Sanders is so specific with his proposals. It makes it much harder for the other candidates to sort of ride sort of broad themes. And here is Beto O'Rourke. He had a CNN town hall last night in Iowa. He's asked a question by a woman who has, I think, ALS or MS?
MS.
MS. And basically, she's talking about how expensive her drugs are. And so Beto, you know, gives a fairly, you know, unspecific, you know, fairly sort of like a sufficient answer from in the past, which is, you've just told me about a problem. I'm going to reiterate the problem, but with different sets of facts, which, you know, all candidates do this. All candidates do this. And that communicates to you and the audience that I understand the problem. And for the most part, every campaign in the past has been to do that part about it is like 75 to 80 to 90% of what is expected. Acknowledge the problem. I, as a citizen who, you know, has some passing awareness of politics, I mean, I'm not talking about me, I'm talking your average person. I just want you to acknowledge the problem, and I will leave it up to you to solve it and figure out what the solution is. But if you acknowledge the problem to me, you've won 90% of my vote. That's the way it's worked in the past to a large extent. I think people are just getting more savvy, particularly in the context of the primary, where that's not enough. I mean, I've mentioned in the past that Barack Obama, during in the run-up to Iowa, came out and said Social Security is in crisis. And he didn't offer any specific policy later on. Before he became president, he was talking about, you know, entitlement reform. But the fact is, Social Security was not in crisis. However, it was an acknowledgement to older voters in Iowa that he understood what was most important to them, which was protecting their Social Security. And the fact that he would notice that there was a crisis, even though there wasn't a crisis, made them feel like, I don't know if there's a crisis or not. I believe there's a crisis because I'm so worried about getting my Social Security. But the fact that he's acknowledging it, he's my guy. He's now in my trust circle, as they call it, because he acknowledges my experience, which is anxiety about, you know, getting that check every month. And so Beto does that, and then he sits down and he thinks, okay, it's over. And because there has been so much emphasis on policy, Dana Bash asks a question that in any other cycle, I don't think she would ask, which is like, why your proposal, which is Medicare for America, which to be honest with you, like, it's so narrowly tailored that it's hard for me to see how it's really fundamentally different from like just a public option in the ACA, which I think it is maybe, but it's a public option that is really not even, you can't even compete with it. You actually have to be means tested into it. And you have to, it sounds like you have to be broke. It sounds like sort of like a Medicaid option.
Right. Is it like what they did in New York here?
I mean, I'm not sure how it measures up to that, but
if you're destitute enough, we'll kick in Medicaid.
It sounds like. I don't know the specifics about the assets that you can have with Medicaid. You can have virtually no assets. I mean, it varies slightly
maybe
state to state.
Make it more generous in terms of who can access it.
Maybe. But that was the
it's
expansion
unclear.
Of Medicaid
it
in the context
like Obamacare
of Obamacare.
Yeah,
but it's not. You know, he calls it Medicare for America because, of course, that sounds like Medicare for all. Like, well, I'm just in America, so that works for me.
It's M for A. Don't you support M for A?
Exactly.
I want Medicare for Singapore, too.
Exactly. All right. But
that's my position.
In any other year, that would be sufficient. But Dana Bash has to ask the question because it is the most obvious question in the context of with so many candidates coming out, making an issue of this. And here this goes, and it doesn't. I don't think it goes very well for Beto because his answer is just not sufficient. Here it is.
So you mentioned your plan or the plan that you signed on to Medicare for America. Why not Medicare for all?
I think about Diane. I think about Joey, a young man, 27 years old, that I met in Laredo, Texas. He's been to a doctor once in his life because he does not have insurance. And that doctor told him that he had diabetes, that he had glaucoma, and that he would be dead before the age of 40 because he's not getting any care right now in this country. Joey, Diane, others, they don't have time for us to get to the perfect solution. If we were to start from scratch, maybe we would start with a single payer, but we've got to work with the system that we have here today. The surest, quickest way to get there is Medicare for America. It guarantees every single person in this country gets the care that they need to live to their full potential and do those things that they were placed on this planet to perform in the first place. So that's why I support that plan.
Okay, so if I understand his answer, it's Texas still hasn't expanded Medicaid, so Joey's SOL. This guy, Joey, age 27, still goes by Joey. That's fine.
Way to zero in on the most pertinent
detail. I don't know.
You're thinking that maybe Beto's taking some liberties here?
I don't know. I don't know about that, but let's just assume that
Let's Beto's... just call you Joey.
Okay. Edwin, let's...
Right.
Jose, maybe it's better if we just call you Joey. Okay. But anyways...
Miguelito, right, so, but Joey.
His answer is... If we attempt to get Medicare for all, I guess it's either it will take too long because, which presumably only could mean like, we won't get it at all because the legislative process, there's no reason to believe that his Medicare for America, when we have already seen the Republicans fight against, Obamacare is going to be any quicker. It's not like what he's talking about can be instituted with any other alacrity. And if it's just about expansion, I mean, if his whole plan just relies on executive action, why not just say, I'm for Medicare for all, And in the meantime, these are the executive action steps I'm going to take. I mean, there is the answer falls apart with the next question, which is, what do you mean? What do you mean? I don't get it. Are you saying that Medicare for All can't pass and yours can with a Republican Congress? Like, what is it that you're arguing? And Dana Bash doesn't ask that question, but it doesn't matter at this point for Beto, because that is clearly not sufficient. All right. This stuff, like, Beto is not going to go from 3% in the polls to 40% in the polls by saying, I know what the best thing is, but I don't think we can do it. So I've got something that is subpar that maybe we can get through. I mean, that is his answer, and that's not going to work. But the point is, that's Joe Biden's campaign. Except for Joe Biden has a little bit more attitude, like, I'm sorry, forgive me, Father. And I'm not cool enough to want to subscribe to the thing that works.
And let me tell you.
Listen, what we're going to go for is something that maybe we can get the Republicans to sign on to, even though they have signed on to nothing. Even though the guy who sits atop the Senate right now has made it his 30-year-long project as a lawmaker to wreak the havoc he is wreaking now, not only on the Senate, but on our country. I mean, it is a completely, in many respects, when Joe Biden gets asked that question, his answer is going to actually be worse than Beto O'Rourke's.
I far prefer Joe Biden's style, though. And I have to say, like, there is something, at least Joe Biden is giving you, like, it's not going to happen, versus, like, here's a whole bunch of words and filler and idealism and complete nonsense, and it's not going to happen, and we can just let people continue
well,
to suffer
under
the
system. Well, I mean, it's quite possible that there are a lot of people out there who are going to vote for Joe Biden because they like his style better, and he doesn't seem as namby-pamby.
I think that's what mostly Beto. It is. Most of this stuff comes down to style.
But I have a feeling that in the context of a primary and debates, that's just not going to be sufficient. Now, part of it is also a function of, like, who he's on the debate stage with. Because there's going to be two debates each time, and it's quite possible that Joe Biden may be in the, you know, the Beto Buttigieg, heat, and isn't paired up with someone like Warren or Sanders, where the contrast will be that stark.
So this isn't, they're not, how are they breaking those up? Are they breaking those up by poll numbers or not?
No, I think it's by lottery.
Oh, so he could luck. If he's up there with Sanders or Warren, he could luck the hell out. Because if he's in there Buttigieging and O'Rourking, first of all, he'll look good, relatively speaking, because I think compared to fake charisma of Beto and Buttigieg's ridiculous kind of faux wonkery, Biden will come off better and no one will hold him accountable.
We'll
because
see.
They're corporatists too.
Sad Beto, though, still into it. The sadder he gets,
well,
the more I
want
to have him over to listen to Fugazi records.
But, you know, I mean, I know that, and I don't know quite what when you have to declare for Senate in Texas. Little Marco was able to get out of the Florida, was able to run in Florida even after his failed presidential bid. So maybe there's time for Beto to get in. And maybe he can transfer that over. But I mean, honestly,
just do it, dude. Come on. You're wasting everybody's time.
I mean,
just run for Senate.
What to be in it?
What better soaring rhetoric than to hold a press conference and say, when I look about how I can serve this country the best, it's clear to me that even though I know I was meant to run for president, I'm going to sacrifice my self-destiny and run for Senate.
It would be like the Ted Cruz challenge era all over again. Everyone would be like, yeah, Beto, we
100%.
Love you, man.
Yeah.
All coverage will be positive here on out if he runs for Senate.
There you go. There's our promise to you, Beto.
Positive YouTube titles.
Hey, do you love the thrill of an escape room looking for clues and solving puzzles? Introducing Hunt a Killer. It's a monthly subscription game where you become a detective immersed in a murder mystery. Each month you'll receive crime scene photos, evidence, motive, and suspect information that you'll need to use to solve a crime. It's so interactive and convincing that it looks and feels real. You'll be racking your brain to solve the mystery and anxiously awaiting the next box of clues. It's perfect to play solo during date night or with friends for a game night so you can swap theories. I got to do this. I have some friends who are starting to get into game nights like this. And this could be pretty good. I mean, there's you think about how many people just watch all those crime shows and listen to the crime podcast. Now you have a chance to be the detective. Right. This is like literally walking around and playing Clue, but better. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so you got to hurry to take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. Do not email me and complain that you didn't move quick enough for this and you got shut out that day. huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first book. Your first box, huntakiller.com/majority.
Matter of fact, don't email me at all.
Exactly.
You don't ever complain to me, do you?
Never.
Huntakiller's on you.
I am so...
you get Huntakiller.
I am so close to this. And Brendan's was telling me about this company that is... Brendan's personally vouching for this company.
That's right. I would say every aspect of this really comes down to
I'm Brendan's. Talking about Boosted.
Here we go. Brendan's into it.
All right. Well, his friend works there and he says it's good company. Time spent in traffic is not time spent exploring, creating, and having fun. The amount of time that I just like getting places, you know, there's always like a 25-minute walk that I've got to take. That would be great if I could make it 5 minutes. Well, you can use Boosted when you need to get there faster. It's designed to provide a luxurious experience. Boosted vehicle-grade electric skateboards and scooters are the modern solution to your transportation woes. They have a 22-mile range, maximum speed of 24 miles an hour. Boosted is perfect for both running to the store and traveling across town. Particularly, I mean, you live in a small town, even this would be even better in many respects. Why take the car?
Could own a small town with one of these.
They have five options to pick from. They have their new scooter, the Boosted Rev. But either way, there's a personal electric vehicle that's tailor-made for you, and they start at $61 a month with financing. It's no wonder Boosted was one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. And I'll tell you what I like about Boosted when I've been all over their site now. Everybody's wearing a helmet. That's super important, folks. Wear a helmet. There's no better time than now to change how you move. Because now Boosted is offering our listeners $75 off the purchase of an electric vehicle when you use the code MAJORITY at checkout. Go to boostedboards.com. And use the code MAJORITY at checkout to get $75 off your vehicle. That's boostedboards.com and promo code MAJORITY at checkout for $75. So cool, these things. All right, let's get into this, what's going on with the immigration. I'll just briefly tell you that... the House Intelligence Committee will not enforce their subpoena against Bill Barr, which was the plan after Wednesday. The Justice Department agreed at the 11th hour to produce redacted material and underlying information from the special counsel's report that the panel sought, albeit more slowly than it wanted. I mean, they're just stringing this out. I mean, and we're going to talk more about this. I get Mehdi Hasan coming on Friday. We're going to talk more about impeachment. But it is becoming more and more likely. It is becoming more and more clear that this is what the administration wants. They think that, rightly or wrongly, they look at Bill Clinton And I've been saying this for months. It would not be irrational for them to look at what happened to Bill Clinton and assume the same thing's going to happen to Donald Trump, which is...
Republicans win seats. Bad for politics.
Well, the impeachment came in the second term.
98.
In 98.
Right. So you helped him get reelected.
And, well, no, it helped...
I'm saying Trump, if you transfer... Is that what you're saying? It would be
politically
beneficial.
His popularity went up. His favorability went up. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, he went from, maybe, I think, in the 40s or 50s of favorability, high 40s, low 50s, to, you know, close to, like, 60s and mid-60s in terms of favorability. And, in fact, the whole movement of Move On was first a function of Move On from the impeachment. And so from Thank their perspective, you. I think it's quite possible they believe it's going to help them. Now, there's really no way to know. There's really no way to know if that's the case. People can speculate. I think there's arguments on both sides. But what is becoming apparent in terms of the dynamic that was not the case during the Clinton years is that the cost to Democrats for not impeaching is much higher than the cost it would have been to Republicans in that day and age. So, but we'll talk more about that with Mehdi Hasan. But that should be in the back of people's minds because that's what's going on here. We have even the EPA is refusing to provide information to House oversight committees, which of course has nothing to do with the witch hunt. So this is not about them. This is about them being, I think, purposefully obstructionist. I mean, and the purpose being to convince Democrats or to put Democrats into a position which is basically a rock and a hard place. And so it's not just a question of goading the Democrats into impeachment. It is putting them in two untenable positions. And generally, I think it's just simply as a life rule. When you're in two untenable positions, choose the one that actually is just the ethically and morally right thing to do. I mean, if both options are going to be problematic for you, do the one that makes you feel like that you're not doing a bad thing too. Never mind an unstrategic thing, because those tend to end up working out better. Meanwhile, there was a confidential IRS legal memo that was prepared in anticipation by the IRS for Steve Mnuchin, anticipating that a Democratic Congress could seek Donald Trump's taxes. And it's a confidential IRS memo, or was confidential. Not clear how this got out. But the Washington Post got a hold of it. Mnuchin has rejected, as of last Friday, a subpoena from the House Ways and Means Committee to turn over the tax returns. This legal memo says the tax returns must be given to Congress unless the president exerts executive privilege. This is according to a copy of the memo obtained by the Washington Post. It contradicts the Trump's administration justification for denying lawmakers' requests for the tax returns. Mnuchin denied the returns by arguing there's no legislative purpose for demanding them. There's a statute, and the statute says that Congress can demand them. They don't need to justify it, and they certainly don't need to justify it to Treasury Department. The disclosure of tax returns to the committee, according to the IRS memo, is mandatory. Requiring the secretary to disclose returns and return information requested by the tax writing chairs. That's the Ways and Means Committee. It's a 10-page document. And it says specifically that the law, quote, does not allow the secretary to exercise discretion in disclosing the information provided the statutory conditions are met, and directly rejects the reason Mnuchin has cited for withholding the information. The secretary's obligation to disclose return and return information would not be affected by the failure of a tax writing committee to state a reason for the request. So not only does the reason not have to be sufficient, there doesn't have to be a reason.
This is as substantive as the Harriet Tubman explanation.
Exactly. Now, supposedly, the agency can refuse to comply if executive privilege is invoked. But it's unclear to me what possible reason, justification there could be invoking executive privilege when these are tax returns that were filed before Donald Trump was president, never involved any people who work in the executive. Executive privilege is supposed to protect the deliberations, private deliberations that you need if you're going to be president of the United States. If I'm president of the United States, I need to be able to say to my advisors, you know, stuff that I wouldn't want to be public. Even if I'm not just expressing my deep hatred for people who are not white, as Donald Trump, there could be other things that are actually, like, not racist that he says that really also you don't want to be made public. I'm sure there's something that he said, but that
delusional things,
there's
all
no
sorts of things.
It's impossible to contemplate. I mean, I guess arguably it's possible to contemplate in the context of his taxes that he files as president, although I find that hard to believe too. And I can't come up with a scenario, but there's can't possibly be a scenario for taxes that have been filed before he was president. So, but be that as it may, that is going to help with the court cases in attempting to get his taxes. All right, but let's go to this HUD stuff. Yesterday, Ben Carson was in front of Congress in the House Oversight. Was this the House Oversight Committee that Ben Carson was in? Quite sure. But it was a HUD hearing. And Ben Carson is up there. And this is following the publishing of a proposal on Friday of last week. Right now, If you are a child and you are an American citizen, you are eligible if you meet the financial requirements for subsidized housing. And your family can join you in that subsidized housing. However, the way that the subsidy is calculated is based upon only those members of your family who are American citizens. So if you are born here in this country, maybe your parents came here on some type of visa, you're born here, you're an American citizen, their visa expires, they stay here, they're not an American citizen, or their visas have expired, or maybe they came in through the border, it doesn't matter. The policy has been, if you are an American citizen, you cannot afford housing. That housing can be subsidized. However, if it's a two-bedroom apartment and the price cost, I don't know, $800, let's say, and they will subsidize it prorated based upon how many American citizens are living in that apartment. So they may only give you, there's four of you in there, they may only give you $200 if there's only one American citizen. But as long as there's one, they will give you that $200. This new proposal would prohibit families in which at least one member is undocumented from obtaining subsidized housing. So it could be that there are three of you who live in that apartment who are citizens, and your grandmother you've brought in from another country. Or there was one child who stayed behind who was not an American citizen. Or one mother or the father. HUD is only subsidizing the American citizens in that apartment. But now HUD is apparently going to prevent the entire family from being in there, or not allowing anybody else in there except for an American citizen. HUD assumes that most mixed households will leave the HUD-assisted housing as a result of this rule, according to this analysis by HUD, because of the fear that the family being separated would lead to would lead to people leaving the homes. Now, here's the thing about this. You've got Ben Carson justifying this by saying it's common sense to just have American citizens in there. But what makes this even worse, Ben Carson's up there calling for 15%, 16% reduction in HUD's budget. This will increase the expense for HUD, because now they will subsidize every member of that apartment. It will not decrease the amount of people who are unable to afford decent housing, because you're going to put four different people in there and you're going to kick four other people out. You're going to increase the homelessness amongst children. 55,000 children are anticipated by HUD's own analysis to be impacted by this. 55,000 children. So it does not in any way help the affordable housing crisis that we have in this country. It cuts into HUD's budget, which he wants to shrink anyways, which means that they're going to take the money, because they're not going to get new money to deal with this greater expense. They're going to take it away from the upkeep of these places and the upkeep of other housing that HUD sponsors. It's going to cost HUD at least almost $200 million more. Their own analysis says it would exacerbate homelessness. And there's an anticipation that it's going to cost the agency money in rent, because families with undocumented immigrants living in there pay their rent more reliably because they are afraid of the scrutiny, right? This is why undocumented are not going en masse to vote in local elections or any elections, because they're afraid. So here is Ben Carson on the Hill. And this guy knows, apparently, we played this yesterday about the Katie Porter exchange, where he didn't know what an REO was, a real estate owned, which is a term about basically when an agency or a bank takes over in a foreclosure because they can't resolve it for the homeowner. Here he is talking to Representative Sylvia Garcia, why HUD is looking to make children of immigrants homeless.
So you're going to shift 55,000 children from being with their families to a homeless status. What's going to happen with these children? Have you thought this program through?
Well, maybe what will happen with them is that you and Congress will do your job and solve the problem.
There you go.
The problem was solved, well, not solved, but slightly mitigated because of at least theoretically what HUD is supposed to do.
Well, this has been a policy
He's
for 20 years. Over
the
20
policy
years.
That was the slight dent in the problem. I mean, that's just such immoral sophistry.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is all, again, part of a broader program to attack immigrants in this country. And we'll get back to that in a moment because there's a horrible story about immigrants who are being put in solitary confinement. In at least half of the occasions, for no reason at all, or really horribly despicable reasons. And this is more of a problem with the agency of ICE than it is necessarily just the Trump administration, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But we have more to say about Ben Carson's tenure at HUD and the pathetic nature of it. So yesterday, Ben Carson, and this is also a failure of the media. And I saw a very good tweet about this. Ben Carson, it's not just that he got humiliated by Katie Porter yesterday when he didn't know what a real estate owned or what that term meant in the context of foreclosure and the disparity between the number of foreclosures under FHA auspices versus Fannie or Freddie Mae. Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And to make light of it, the fact that Ben Carson thought that real estate owned, that Katie Porter was saying OREO, he put out a funny tweet, his agency did. Here's a picture of him holding a bag of OREOs to make the joke of like, at the end of the day, and here he is, he's sending a package of OREOs, family size, to Representative Porter. See, I don't have any hard feelings about the fact that I had no idea about what a major component of my agency does.
Talk about the banality of evil.
Yes. Well, what's even more problematic is that that he did this got more write-up than the actual issue itself. Because reporters to go in and look at, like, why is it that the FHA is basically executing more foreclosures than Fannie and Freddie? And I think this is on a per capita basis. And Katie Porter made the point after Ben Carson humiliated himself that this is also leading to a lot of urban blight. Because when you have a foreclosed home that is owned by a bank or an agency in this instance, they are not keeping, they're not mowing the lawn. They're not keeping vandals out. They're not, I mean, when you don't live in a house, even for like a couple of months, things start falling apart on their own. The general upkeep, things like water and HVAC stuff, if these aren't used on a regular basis, it becomes problematic. It's like if you let your car sit for too long, the brakes start to rust out. I mean, this is what houses need to be lived in. And when they're not, they start to fall apart. And when they start to fall apart and you start to get this type of blight, you start to hurt the entire neighborhood.
Yeah,
not
but
to
then
mention,
real estate speculators can come in and make money on blighted areas.
Well, sometimes it's just they sit there in blight.
No, most of the time it's like the girl with tattoos said, it turns into good things for speculators.
But that's actually not the case.
Okay,
there's a lot of times where that blight just exists for years and years and years, and people get trapped in these neighborhoods, and they can't sell their homes because nobody wants to move in to that area because there's so much blight. It breeds crime and obviously other problems, and not to mention the people who get foreclosed upon. They lose their homes. So Ben Carson went on a little bit of a tour on the right to, I guess, in some way, relieve the embarrassment. Who better to rub salve on that embarrassment than Stuart Varney?
Yes, it was. First of all, it was 3.5 hours of testimony. So you can see that some of the networks are only interested in those kinds of sound bites used to ridicule. You know, the fact of the matter is I was having difficulty hearing her.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm very familiar with foreclosed properties and with REOs, have read extensively about them, knew about them even as a teenager. There was a lot of blighted areas.
Pause it for 1 second. He didn't just say OREO when she said that. She said, no, REO. Do you know what that stands for? And he said, real estate organizations?
It had been going on for 3 hours, and maybe some of us are human beings and don't spend all of our lives looking at Social Security and Medicare updates. That's called a subtweet.
Or some of us may not even spend our lives digging into any of the literature about the agency that we're running for the U.S. government. Continue.
Detroit, where I grew up. But what is interesting is that, you know, when a family gets into a problem with their mortgage and it's backed by our agency, we go through a lot of procedures with the banks to make sure that they don't get foreclosed upon. In a few cases where they do, obviously we're able to sell those properties very quickly. And the REO portfolio, just over the last 10 years, has dramatically decreased by tenfold. Yeah. You know, $65,000
down to $6,500. Pause it. What happened 10 years ago? 10 years ago, it was 2009.
There was statistically...
We had the greatest crash in the value of real estate, perhaps, in the history of the country.
Would you like to know what really happened?
And so the number of foreclosed homes there, obviously... Now, of course, it's dropped 10 years because those homes at one point, they go away. It runs out. The number of foreclosures that are happening there. But the bottom line is the FHA, the agency that he oversees as Secretary of HUD, is having more foreclosures, continues to have far more foreclosures. She stated to him after that moment, that exchange, that there is a massive study that shows the FHA is responsible in many respects for an enormous amount of blight. He is lying. Lying to Stuart Varney.
Yeah. You know, $65,000 down to $6,500. So I suspect when Katie Porter was an expert in this area, things were very different. That's why I invited her to speak with our staff that deals with these so they can bring her up to date. Yeah. Maybe she would then be able to understand what's going on.
I think they were just having a go at you.
Yeah.
But that's
I think they were just
called,
having a go at you.
That's it called a like... haymaker. So I was Katie. What she did was she was at university years ago, and now she doesn't know what she thinks she knows.
Well, one of us doesn't know what's going on. I think I know who it is.
I think we all know who it is. I didn't want to be rude. It was embarrassing to watch her throw these terms around. They're out of date. And now you have this smug guy whose ass is on YouTube just talking all sorts of verbal nonsense. Meanwhile, the economy collapsed because there was a lack of prayer.
Katie Porter and Sylvia Garcia were the only ones who embarrassed Ben Carson. Ayanna Pressley went on to ask Carson about the disrepair of HUD houses. Now, understand, this policy that they announced, in addition to Carson looking for a cut in his own budget at HUD, the policy that they announced about kicking out families, separating families who have any undocumented immigrants living in the household, is going to increase costs for HUD They're going to have to pay more subsidies. They're going to get less back in rent, according to their own analysis. And they're going to have to take money away from upkeep of HUD homes. So just understand that in the context of this, of what Presley is asking him.
When we are eliminating a stock but not increasing supply, people in the Massachusetts 7th Congressional District would have to work 84 hours to afford a decent one-bedroom at fair market rent. Doris Bunty, who's a former Massachusetts state representative in my district and was the first African-American woman to hold the position of head of BHA, the first public housing tenant to lead a public housing agency in a major city. She said, being poor is not a character flaw. I agree. But again, given your medical background, perhaps you could weigh in on the health consequences of failing to invest in safe housing. Mr. Secretary, since I am short on time here, yes or no, is stable and safe housing a social determinant of health?
Sounds like you have not been here and heard most of my testimony.
Please just answer the question, reclaiming my time. Yes or no, is stable and safe housing a social determinant of health?
There is no question that housing is an important part of
health. Yes or no?
No question that it's a part of health.
It is well documented that health problems such as lead poisoning, asthma, and injuries from trips and falls, especially amongst our senior population, can be linked to substandard housing conditions. Combined, these conditions result in billions a year in health care costs. Many of those most at risk of developing these conditions reside in public and federally assisted housing. Yes or no? If left unaddressed, do you believe the substandard public housing conditions pose a risk to tenants' physical, mental, and emotional health? If left unaddressed?
Yes or no? Can you ask me some questions yourself?
You don't get to dictate what my line of questioning is, reclaiming my time. You're a very smart man. So you understand the question. Please answer it. Yes or no? If left unaddressed, which I believe they are unaddressed because this budget does not reflect the need, do you believe the substandard public housing conditions pose a risk to tenants' physical, mental, and emotional health?
You already know the answer to that.
Yes or no?
You know the answer.
Yes or no? I know the answer. Do you know the answer? Yes or no?
Reclaiming my time.
You don't get to do that.
No.
The time belongs to the gentlelady.
The evidence is clear that if we do not invest the necessary funds today, we will pay the price in people's health tomorrow. And what is this administration's response? Cuts. Cuts to crucial funding like the Public Housing Operating Fund and the Family Self-Sufficiency Program, Section 202 housing for elderly and Section 811, housing for persons with disabilities, and even the complete elimination of the Public Housing Capital Fund. These policies are devoid of empathy and humanity, and you've been talking in the abstract, but I want to get specific. There's a Miss Northcross, a mother and a grandmother living in Brighton in my district. She's raised her children and now cares for her grandchildren in property with thick mold on the walls. Her son was recently hospitalized, look at the pictures here, because of bone tumors in his arm and leg. He needs surgery to save and improve his quality of life, but he won't get it because the family must have a sanitary, stable housing condition first. Their actual home literally poses a risk of post-op injury and infection. Her question to you is, what do they become? When you raise children in these conditions, what can they become? So yes or no? Do Ms. Norcross and her family deserve to live in these conditions because they are poor?
If you've listened to any...
Yes or no, do they deserve to live in these conditions because they are poor?
You know very well...
Would you let your grandmother live in public housing?
You know very well...
Would you let your grandmother live in public housing, yes or no?
You know very well...
Under your watch and at your helm, would you allow your grandmother to live in public housing under these conditions?
Would be very nice if you would stop...
You stated that
the gentleman from Florida, Mr. Lawson, is recognized for.
He really is. He's a psychopath.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that he would have done that if Ayanna Presley was white?
I was thinking that.
Like that level of disrespect. Like I just don't think that he gets away with that. If he is talking, you know, to anybody but a black woman, I don't know how he gets away. I mean, that attitude is just unbelievable.
I think he would do it to anybody that was advocating for people in low-income housing. I would definitely do it to Bella Abzug, I'll tell you that much.
I don't know.
I reserve the right for my time back.
I wish you would stop being that way.
I reserve my time. Would you stop being that way?
The contempt he's like the way he laughed.
Honestly, It's disgusting.
He had one moment in the campaign. I think it was actually after when he was a surrogate for Trump. And, you know, they were outlining, you know, all of Trump's various disgusting behavior and saying, like, just the basic, like, hey, you know, you're a Christian. And he snapped. He has this very weird thing. And he was just like, that's crap. Can I finish? And he does. It's interesting. He does.
He's a bad guy.
Yeah, no. Behind that sort of like, you know, coma exterior, he's a genuinely very awful person and a disgusting, empathy-free person, exactly who they want torturing people in public housing.
It's disgusting. He's got the same thing as Trump going on. He's like, no matter how serious it is, he's going to act like a high school bully.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. It really is. It was just sort of shockingly disgusting. All right, we got to take a break. Head into the fun half. We've got clips of Steve Mnuchin at the House Oversight Committee hearing. This on what's that? Was it financial services? It says House Oversight here. Oh, House Financial Services. Okay. This is all in particularly just sort of becomes a little bit more hypercharged with this leak of this IRS memo. We've also got clips of some of the abortion protests across the country, people seeking their rights to have sovereignty over their own bodies, and a horrible story. I guess this is the fun half. Let's just, I want to play this clip too before we go, because people should be aware of this. And this is, and I want to make this clear, this report from NBC is about the use of solitary confinement by ICE for people who are, this sounds just, it's unbelievable, but it's basically for people who are mentally ill or disabled, or some instances because they're transgender or gay, or because they have reported abuse from guards or other detainees, they are put into solitary confinement. Remember that most psychiatrists will say solitary confinement is a form of torture. And for folks with mental illness, it's even worse. This is a practice, apparently, that has been going on with ICE for at least since 2012. These records document solitary confinement cases from 2012 to 2017. They were obtained under the Freedom of Information Act by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. They were shared with NBC and apparently other news organizations. So this predates Trump. In nearly one-third of the cases, of the cases of people put in solitary confinement were determined by ICE itself to have a mental illness. Only half the cases of where people are put into solitary confinement, according to ICE's own documents, only half the cases involved punishment for rule violations. The other reasons were just because, I guess, theoretically to protect them or from themselves or other people. And which is not to say that there should be anybody going to solitary confinement. But even according to their own records, ICE only put only half the people they put in solitary confinement would done so because it was being punished. Here is a part of that report from NBC.
We have created and continue to support a system that involves widespread abuse of human beings.
Ellen Gallagher works in the Office of the Inspector General at the Department of Homeland Security. In 2014, she was with a different DHS office where she reviewed civil rights complaints and was troubled by what she saw in ICE's own files, hundreds of immigrant detainees being put in solitary confinement every week. Most troubling for her, cases involving the mentally ill. A schizophrenic detainee sentenced to 390 days in solitary for throwing human waste at a guard. Another mentally ill detainee got 15 days because he had a green pepper in his sock.
The notes specifically said he had hidden the green pepper.
A green pepper.
A half a green pepper.
ICE's policy states that detainees should be segregated only after careful consideration of alternatives.
Solitary confinement was being used as the first resort, not the last resort. And sometimes it was the only approach.
In a statement to NBC News, a spokesperson says ICE is firmly committed to the safety and welfare of all those in its custody. The use of restrictive housing in ICE detention facilities is exceedingly rare, but at times necessary to ensure the safety of staff and individuals in a facility. Between 2014 and 2018, Gallagher sent memos detailing her concerns up the chain.
How would you characterize the overall response to the concerns you raised?
Muted.
Why are you speaking up now?
Because if I didn't speak up, I don't think I could live with myself.
An NBC News review of ICE data found more than 8,000 cases of immigrants held in solitary confinement in local, private, and federal facilities under both the Obama and Trump administrations. A third of them involved the mentally ill, including one put in isolation for nearly 2 years. At least seven have committed suicide while in solitary. Dulce Rivera, an immigrant from Honduras, tried to hang herself while in solitary in New Mexico.
I mean, imagine if that report, the everything, word for word, was done about, I don't know, China or any other country for that matter.
Russia.
We've invaded countries for way less than that.
I mean,
views as a pretext.
Just imagine that that is just presented in, you know, all the participants in there just were speaking a different language and we were just reading subtitles. The outcry would be amazing. I mean, this is, you know, when they talk about abolishing ICE, which apparently has not been, it's sort of like, you know, left the consciousness for the moment. This is why. This is a perfect example of an agency that is simply out of control and is so decrepit and corrupt at its core that it's incapable of being reformed. This is, I imagine, also a part of, you know, the privatization, because the controls over who administer this stuff is just, you know, much more, I guess, relaxed. I mean, it's really...
Obscene. Absolutely obscene.
Man, we're doing a lot of bad news today. The good news is that the right-wing a-holes who were in the government of Austria all got caught on tape basically willing to accept bribes for a Russian oligarch.
Leave it be open. This is something we can negotiate.
They've all had to resign. So how's that for some happy news?
I would say they're a bunch of losers.
We also have some fun Brexiter on Brexiter violence.
Yeah, let's save that.
Oh, man, that is so good. That's going to definitely improve everybody's
half.
Mood.
Right. We're going to go into the fun half, and mostly fun stuff in the fun half. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, we give you extra content every day. And not only do we do that, but we also give it to you a commercial free. On Monday, for instance, Memorial Day, we're not going to have a free show. We're just going to put up a members show, and it's going to be an archived interview that I did with Chris Hayes back in 2009 or 2010, when we're talking about – it's an interesting interview because – we talk about some of the problems that we were anticipating coming forward and the Republicans' attack on norms at that time. I know this was only supposed to be about Trump, but we will put that out for members. You will have access to it if you're a member. How's that? Also, introducing Hunt a Killer, a monthly subscription game where you become a detective immersed in a murder mystery. It's so interactive and convincing that it looks and feels real. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so hurry to take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. huntakiller.com/majority. Michael, last night was Tuesday. Apparently, you did your so-called...
Wait, real quick, before we get to that, do you want to talk about the Mark Crispin Miller thing?
Oh, right. Yes. We're going to put a link in this.
There is a link on the blog post.
Okay. Longtime listeners of this program will remember that one of our regular guests back on the radio was a guy named Mark Crispin Miller. He was a professor at NYU, communications professor. In fact, I had a very funny moment with him on the original Majority Report. I was quoting a piece that I had read about television. This was, 10 or 15 years ago that I had read maybe 10 or 15 years earlier. Maybe I read it in the early 90s. And I couldn't remember where it was from. I thought it was from a David Foster Wallace essay. But it was basically about the dynamic of television where the act of watching television, and this may have changed based upon, all the technology, frankly, and the bar being lowered. But at the time, the act of being television, basically the subtext of it was because you're not being watched, because you're not on television, you're less than. And like the whole experience was to put focus on people behind this glass. And somehow this came up in our conversation with him. And I said, I can't remember. I think it was David Foster Wallace. And he goes, that was me. I actually quoted. I didn't realize that he had written the book that I had read. And it was a total McLuhan moment. And he said, that was me. I wrote that. And I was like, oh, I'm so happy to meet you. perhaps I should have done a little more research. He apparently, and this is, this is another one of those stories. It's like, what the F? But he apparently has had undiagnosed Lyme disease that he's had since 2011. And I have a lot of experience with Lyme disease. My ex-wife had had Lyme disease. It took about a year to get rid of. Unfortunately, she had... she caught it fairly early, but he is suffering from all sorts of secondary symptoms from the Lyme disease. He has an opportunity to get oxygenization therapy, but apparently, my guess is that his insurance doesn't cover it. And so he has been his production has been way off obviously as of late, but things like Hidden News in the past. So if you have the ability to help him get to his $20,000 goal, do so. We'll put a link.
He also curated something called the Forbidden Bookshelf series.
Yes,
which
right.
has a bunch of really great books. There's one called Lords of Creation by Frederick Lewis Allen. That's great. One on the Phoenix Program in Vietnam. I want to read everything in that series.
I think we may have had him on early on in this version of the show to talk about that. I feel like back in 2000, maybe around the time that he got... he got the limes.
Yeah, there's one on the Orlando Letelier assassination too. Really good.
So check that out. Help if you can. Meanwhile, last night was Tuesday night, otherwise known as the sting, people are calling it in my emails. The Sting, of course, is a reference to a famous movie from the 70s with Paul Newman and Robert Redford about the Long Con. And people are equating Michael's whole, like, if we get to 2,000 patrons, I will eat from a one of these survival post-apocalyptic dinner things. People didn't realize that what he said, well, I will eat as much as I want, as opposed to some type of challenge. Doing stuff that you want to do, not a challenge. Despite the fact that you don't want to do it, a challenge.
I will say,
it didn't look like he wanted to do it at all.
We did not want to do any of it. And I'll just say this, too. I mean, I think Matt should maybe sort of explain the breakdown.
Don't try and implicate Matt in on this. I mean,
Matt opened the bucket and was the first to say, that doesn't smell like bad food. That smells like industrial not food. And if Matt says that with his dietary habits, true. That's extremely revealing. Then we were shocked that, I mean, basically, if you're in a survival scenario, I don't see how this is that handy. It's very heavy to carry around. It's impractical to pack. Presumably, you don't have a water heater around you. I guess you'd need to, like, build some sort of fire or something.
What do you think? You're going to survive a post-apocalyptic world without being able to create fire and find water?
Of course not, but I'm thinking more like things are burning down. You're running. You want to throw something instant.
It's got 196 meals in there.
All of which are not
that.
That's
for your stationary bunker when you've got the generator hooked up.
Yeah, if you were in your stationary bunker when you had the generator hooked up, I'm going to recommend you go for some better product. But so we didn't, and Jamie helpfully reminded us, because we thought we were going to be able to eat any of it, and she promptly texted me and said, "There's a water heater here," and I can only imagine
what your reaction to that was. Like, damn it!
No, my reaction could have been to ignore it. My reaction was to publicly say on the show, hey, we actually do have a heater here.
You know, Jamie
would have
been
right
on the Discord
saying,
"I just told him there's a hot water heater in there."
I don't know. I don't know if Jamie's a rat. I hold her in higher esteem.
It's not a rat. It's a consumer advocate. Is what it is.
So,
do I care more about my solidarity with you as a fellow worker, or as somebody of whom I am?
Oh, he wasn't doing this.
No, I was doing this as a
worker.
Yeah, don't worry. I was doing it as a capitalist class.
So technically, I'm your boss in that scenario.
There you go.
You're a consumer. You're like somebody who would write a Yelp review, which is just slightly above a rat. So basically, that was
ratreports.org, I guess.
That
right?
was so disgusting. I was
we have
actually
some footage
shocked.
Of it if we want to watch it here.
We have some footage of this. This is real. This is disturbing. This is all you're going to see, by the way, because we're not clipping this. All right. I'm taking my full bite here.
What a baby.
The beef is where the memory warning comes from.
Wow.
Brendan Sutton sat there and watching us do this said was like it was like his reparations. Wow. It was so amusing.
But all these excuses, it's like we just replayed the HUD the HUD hearing.
Of
again.
Course I said that I wouldn't do more than take a bite. I had been very clear the whole time. In addition to that,
I'm announcing my survival food challenge.
Oh, go eat that. Go eat it, Sam.
How many meals you had? You had two meals?
Yeah, we tasted from three meals. I think.
Oh, you tasted?
Yeah, we had a little sample menu.
You tasted. It's like one of those like expos on a Sunday. Like we've got like 162 restaurants in Brooklyn. We just tasted.
I will say, like, as someone who tuned into this, like, very excited to watch, we got what we came for. Like, we definitely, there was a sufficient amount of, like, retching, unless he was just faking the whole thing. Like, I was satisfied.
None of us were faking that.
I will personally,
Uchi Wally insisted, our friend, patron who was there visiting, insisted on trying it. And he went very quickly from basically, like, guys, stop it. This is, like, whatever. Stop being babies. tasted it and went, "Ooh, gee, I don't know if that's safe to eat."
Well, I should have saw the eggs.
Oh man, the eggs.
I will.
That is a scientific accomplishment.
Why didn't you guys leave us any leftovers?
There are people floating.
The bucket is still right here,
People are floating the idea that I would taste from four meals.
Go for it.
And but the challenge would be if 500 of your patrons leave to join the Majority Report.
Wow.
Then I would try.
This is just pure oligarch class warfare, you know? I came up from nothing. I grew up in total poverty. You're the son of a lawyer.
Hold on one second.
You're a rentier. You already leech from my broadcast on a regular basis. And the fact that you would... Oh, this is your true color. See, this is what Sam really thinks of poor people. This is what Sam really thinks of the struggle. This is what Sam really thinks.
This is what I think about consumer advocacy.
This is why Sam is secretly voting for Biden. Sam is not a good guy, folks. He doesn't care. This is why he was always like, "I don't think Hillary's really that bad. I don't think Hillary's really that bad. I don't think she would do that."
Tim Black's going to do like four episodes on this.
Now, Michael Brooks, he revealed Sam Cena. Seth Meyers finally got fed up. Said the truth about oligarch Sam. That's why Sam talked about Russia every single second.
I was protecting my fellow oligarchs.
If we talk about Russia, then maybe my upstate second home won't be taxed.
There you go.
And then I could steal money from my employee. Look at my dreidel.
Wow.
You know where that joke came from, the dreidel joke?
No.
You know where that came from, right?
Yes,
Protocols?
From anti-Semitism?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
No, that was the first Ilhan Omar impression with "the world has been hypnotized." It's like, they spin their dreidels, and then everyone is deceived.
Yeah, whatever.
Brandon and I talked about capitalist realism.
That anti-Semitism came from an earlier anti-Semitic joke I made.
Well, the trouble is,
you have people
like you working so hard to fortify anti-Semitic
jokes. You mean you,
tropes.
Like the Jews?
Is stovepiping anti-Semitic jokes?
Jesus.
We should have saved this for the fun half.
Yeah.
Matt, what else? We talked about the distinction between Warren and Sanders, why green imperialism is not going to do the trick. And we did a history of this idea of greening the military as like a way of triangulating the climate message, going back to Thomas Friedman and the Global Business Network. Sanders' foreign policy history, we gave shout outs to the union that wouldn't load. Did we talk about that yesterday on Majority Report?
We headlined it. Italian.
Okay. Italian union that wouldn't load arms shipments for Saudi Arabia. Notorious BIG.
They weren't
47.
Loading arms shipments. They were loading electrical equipment onto a shipment
that had arms. Right. So they refused to do that in Genoa. And Brandon and I talked about ideology. I mean, I won't explain much. Brandon's a brilliant, really interesting guy. And so I would listen to and watch us, and I'd also check out the discourse, and we should have him on a Friday sometime. And we also inaugurated a new segment called The Daily Show Gone Bad, where we did some media criticism of Hasan Minhaj's coverage of Brazil.
Yeah. It's where we criticize media figures we're envious of.
Media figures that we're purely envious of, but who are also genuinely not funny. And are perpetuating horrible beliefs on Brazil. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, our producer Andy is back from his travels presenting on Posadas at Cuba's first Trotsky conference, as well as Red May in Seattle. And he's got four interviews, which we ran this week. Isabel Diaz Torres from the Anarchist Biblioteca Abra in Cuba, who was actually arrested after this interview for staging a protest against homophobia, which is kind of insane. Simón Rodríguez from Partido Socialismo y Libertad of Venezuela, who is part of the left opposition to both Maduro and Guaido, a producer of the audio zine podcast Resonance Audio, and Philip Walsletter of Red May, who wraps everything up with his story of backpacking to Chile in 1973 during the coup.
Matt,
Yeah, Literary Hangover, the Margaret Fuller episode will be out for patrons, I believe, tomorrow evening. We are 7 patrons shy of 200. We're not going to be eating anything for that celebration.
Well,
no more debasing.
Good that you aren't over-promising. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half, 646-257-3920.
3,000 patrons, yoga class, and wine bar.
646-257-3920.